Welcome to NucleCast, the official podcast of the Ann Law Deterrence Center. Our host is Dr. Adam Lauther, co-founder and vice president for research at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. The Ann Law Deterrence Center is a 501c3 organization ensuring a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrence and its ongoing modernization. Thank you for listening and welcome to the show. The views of the host and the guests are their own.
Welcome back to another great episode of NucleCast. Of course, I'm your host, Adam Lauther, and today, again, two great guests, Kyle Balzer, Bob Peters. They've been on NucleCast before. You know their background, and so they wrote an article. It's been about a week and a half now in Breaking Defense, and the article was called "Forge Ahead with the Sentinel ICBM, but Consider Making It Mobile." And the argument that Bob and Kyle and Rebecca Heinrichs make is that we should consider making all or part, and you can go into more detail, of the ICBM, the Sentinel Force, mobile instead of, having a purely silo-based force. So with that, let me turn it over to you guys. Kyle, maybe you can kick us off, and then we'll turn to you, Bob. Tell us what you were thinking and sort of your argument and why you think we should go mobile.
Sure, Adam. And it's a real pleasure to be back on the show. I think the major motivation behind the piece was just a recent GAO report, which came out on the difficulties with the transition to the Sentinel ICBM. It made aware that extending the Minuteman III, we can do it till 2050, but there's some sense that the cost will increase as we extend the life of the Minuteman III. And so with life extension, with the costs going up for that in all likelihood, and then with the costs of transitioning to a silo-based next-generation ICBM, the Sentinel, Bob and Rebecca and I thought it would be worthwhile to take another look at a mobile next-generation Sentinel basing mode, that maybe the cost-effectiveness and the economics behind a mobile basing option had changed since this was first looked at in the mid-2010s. I think it was looked at in the early 2020s. And so with the Nunn-McCurdy cost violations and with the GAO report, Bob and Rebecca and I thought it would be worthwhile that at least to take a look at a mobile option.
Yeah. Bob, did you want to add to that?
Yeah. I mean, you know, what I'd say is that some folks may say, well, we looked at this and it was too expensive. It's just cheaper to keep with the silo. But my understanding is that analysis was made with the assumption that we could put the Sentinels in the existing Minuteman III silos. And using that assumption, it's probably correct. But what we know now is that the Minuteman III silos cannot really accommodate the Sentinel. We've got to dig new silos for the ICBM force. And so once you add that into the equation, that's where the real cost driver is coming from for Sentinel. It's not really the rocket itself. The rocket itself is actually coming along kind of nicely, and it's within relative standards for cost for a DoD program.
It's under budget, actually. The missile's actually under budget right now.
Yeah, right. And so what is the huge, enormous cost driver? And some folks, some of our friends in the arms control community has said it's like 80% over budget. Well, yeah, but that's because we're now having to dig new silos, new tunnels, new command and control nodes, and so forth. And that's what's driving the cost to go up. And so if you had a mixed force of road mobile Sentinel and silo-based Sentinel, you wouldn't have to dig so many holes because you'd be putting some subset of that force on the back of trucks with some erector launchers. Now, there may be some challenges there, but I mean, mobile erector launchers and TELs, those are things that the Soviets and even, you know, God help us, North Koreans have figured out. So if they can make it work and make it cost effective, I'm relatively confident that we can figure out how to make it cost effective as well. And so the piece, and I really want to tip my hat, Kyle was really the driving force behind this paper, was, hey, DoD, why don't you take a look at this as an option, see if it makes sense, and maybe you can get some Sentinels out before 2050 so that you can keep the cost down, but then also have a bit of a mixed force between silo base and mobile. And there's some other reasons as well as to why you may want a subset of the Sentinel force to be mobile if you're looking at a period, say in the 2070s or 2080s, when the SSBNs, or ballistic missile submarines, may no longer be undetectable. And we can talk about that as well. But really, this piece was, hey, DoD, why don't you guys think about this? Take a real look at it.
Yeah, there's question of the silo, the digging new holes, pouring new concrete from new silos is the major driver of the cost. And I think we're now dealing with a two-paired nuclear threat environment. And so I think that also needs to be added in to the cost effectiveness calculation. And there's a sort of effectiveness, military effectiveness, and greater mobility now that we're dealing with the Chinese as a peer nuclear competitor as well. And so we need greater survivability. And so the mobile option, I think it's the effectiveness and the cost effectiveness is driven not just by the rising cost of building new silos, but also just the need for enhanced survivability in dealing with the rise of China as a nuclear peer.
So one of the things, you know, I've given a lot of thought to this question over the years, and I've sort of wavered as to whether I like it or don't like it. And one of the challenges is you have a similar problem that you would have with bombers, in that bombers are largely useless if they're not on alert, because they're easily destroyed if they're not on alert, particularly in an initial first strike where we don't have strategic warning time. Because, you know, to load bombers, to then disperse bombers, that takes time, takes quite a bit of time. And so if we had mobile ICBMs in, you know, let's say in a basing mode in which they're together as opposed to dispersed, then in a first strike, you know, you actually need fewer adversary weapons to, you know, to take them out. So you would need them kind of in a constantly dispersed, constantly mobile method. And I just, and, you know, and I think he was one of your former colleagues, Kyle, James McHugh wrote a really nice paper where he looked at, you know, do you have a racetrack? Do you have a dispersed basing in, let's say, Arizona, or, you know, some other sort of hide sites, things like that, in which you pick how you want this, but you essentially keep your mobile assets constantly moving or hidden. Have you guys given any thought to sort of those trade-offs that when you look at like mobile basing and just how you might do mobile basing? And then, you know, the good thing about having to pour new holes is that concrete was, you know, in the Minuteman III silo was built for a time when the, you know, Soviet ICBMs had a CEP of, you know, 1 kilometer, as opposed to, you know, they're within 200 meters now. So, you know, pouring new holes might be a really good thing, and might be useful. And then, you know, I've thought about like drones. How are mobile ICBMs susceptible to, you know, adversary drones, or, you know, pick the new technologies, rods from God, you name it. So as you guys thought about all this different stuff, kind of what was the machinations going on in your minds as you tried to, you know, assess trade-offs?
I mean, what I would say is we're agnostic as to what the basing is or what the operational, you know, what the CONOP is for how you would use these things, right? And as you point out, you could keep them in garrison and then bring them out of garrison in times of crisis. You hit a certain DEFCON mode or whatever. That's one option. Another option is you've got multiple bases and you can still disperse. Another option is they have regular deployments on randomized circuits in which you've got a circuit of land in which you operate, like in an unpopulated area like Montana or Alaska would be a really great place for it, in which you've got airmen out and operating these things. And so we're not smart enough to answer that question. We know that there are trade-offs, and I think we defer to the experts in the Air Force to figure out what would make the most sense. But I do think that none of the things that we've looked at are showstoppers for why you could not do this. And I think a lot of, like, I've seen some reactions to the piece, and it's like, well, don't you know that, like, Russian Spetsnaz could, like, take those things out in short order. I'm like, okay, like, if a bunch of Russians are running around rural Montana with Kalashnikovs waiting for the gigantic Sentinel to be rolling by, like, I think we'll spot those dudes. And it's not like, you know, it's not like a Mack truck out in the, you know, in the high lonesome on an I-94 by itself. There would be a convoy of security specialists and so forth. So if, in fact, like, Russians did pull up, you know, there would be a firefight, and I'd hope that our dudes would be able to protect that missile. And the same thing with, like, drones, right? Like, you can see drones. Like, there are drone detection capabilities and anti-drone capabilities that would have to be part of this convoy that are pretty darn effective if they're employed correctly. And so, like, I know there's a lot of people that do the, you know, well, there could be rods from gods. Well, if the adversaries have rods from gods, like, that, well, that's a
They
whole
don't
nother
need.
problem that we've got to deal with besides, like, you know, taken out of tell. So
I
and you
have heard, have I don't know if you knew about this, but there was a case, I think it was back in the 1980s, where two American spies were able to thwart a Russian, a Soviet launch from one of their road mobile systems. I don't know if you remember that.
yeah,
I
they were
think they
both
did a
doctors.
doc.
They were both doctors. Yeah.
I think
And
they
on
made a
the
documentary, didn't they? It was called, what was it called? Spies Like Us, I think that
Spies
was
Like
the name
Us,
of
yeah.
it. Go ahead,
And
Kyle. Sorry.
on the issue of maintaining the ICBM leg's propness, any conflict will most likely, I believe, most nuclear analysts believe, will come out of a local or regional conventional conflict. So you will have time to, say, flush these mobile launchers, the TELs, onto whatever basing circuit you choose to go with. You know, I think the notion of a bolt from the blue surprise nuclear attack at the outset of a conflict is really a construct of 1950s Cold War scenarios. So I think that any sort of nuclear scenario would be a gradual progression out of a local conventional conflict, would allow you to maintain the promptness of the ICBM leg with a road mobile basing option, really.
Yeah, I guess let me push back on that one just for the sake of thinking about World War I and World War II, and you know how you know historical conflicts tend to start, and they tend to start with you know the desire to achieve surprise on with a surprise attack. You know, let's say Pearl Harbor. So I probably think that it'll be a surprise attack, but you know if you're you know if you had adequate basing structure, you could probably figure it out or survive it, or you know there's lots of different you know scenarios where you could do it. But so have you guys looked at sort of any, have you seen any like data on how long it would take? Because the US has never built a TEL, so have you talked to anybody that might have a sense of, hey, it's going to take X number of years to build out Sentinel? And you know, somewhat ironically, whenever we built, you know, the silos the first time around, we were building one every 3 days. Could you imagine building a Sentinel silo every 3 days? It's hard to imagine we could do that. It's like it would take years per. But like, do we have any sense of when we could have like TELs ready? A year, 2 years? What could we have them ready when the missiles are ready?
My understanding is that so the road mobile basing option would be like on the back end. If you're extending Minuteman threes out to 2050, right, we have some time. So my understanding would be you'd start laying down the Sentinel in these new silos, and then you'd get the research and development done on a road mobile basing option. You wouldn't need those to come first. You would start laying down the Sentinel in a mixed silo based force, and then you could bring on the road mobile option later on. So that could be like in 15, 20 years. I think we could do it in 10, from what I've heard. But again, it would be a mixed force, so we could always go with laying down Sentinel in the new silos first.
What I would say is, like, we're already testing Sentinel, the rocket itself, in above ground, right? And so, like, turns out, you know, we can light those puppies off above ground, and I bet we probably used a truck to get out to the test site to bring the Sentinel out there, and then we erected the rocket so that I could do the test. And so it's not like we're inventing the light bulb here. Like, I have full faith in American ingenuity to figure this puppy out in relatively short order. The problem is I think we have this risk-averse culture, and Adam, you and I have talked about this before, in the Department of Defense, in which it's this accept zero risk culture when it comes to contracting, when it comes to procurement, when it comes to testing, when it comes to even just how you move money. And I think we really need to move past this sense of it takes years upon years upon years to build things in America. And I think we have to be willing to accept greater risk of failure and learn quickly and move fast it. And to do that, we have to be willing to accept some operational risk. We have to accept some personnel risk. We have to be willing to accept some environmental risk in order to make these things happen. I mean, it took us 3.8 years to build the Golden Gate Bridge. And it's now been 18 months since the Key Bridge was hit in Baltimore, and we have yet to build a replacement for the Key Bridge. The California High-Speed Rail initiated in 2008, and they have yet to lay a single mile of track. And so we just need, as a nation, need to move faster. And then once we decide to do that, like, I have full confidence that we could crank out a tell within 18 months if we wanted to.
And to my mind, the biggest issue isn't necessarily the engineering aspect of it. It's more the land acquisition ability. If you look back at the MX basin controversy that lasted forever in the late 70s, 80s, the biggest problem was political. Dealing with the Reagan-voting Wyoming ranchers was the biggest hurdle in terms of getting the MX out there. The land acquisition controversy, which was a political issue, had nothing to do with, you know, strategic issues, engineering feats, any of that sort. And so I think, you know, the major issue is where do you get the land? Where do you get the space to have these missiles drive around? Would first and foremost to me be the major issue. And so that's political. And so I think the main point of our piece is you need to get this studied now. And if it's feasible to do so, the decision needs to be made now. So you need to get a political campaign behind this, and this will involve talking directly to American voters, especially out there in the states, and these citizens that this will be have some sort of a direct impact on. So to me, it all comes back to the politics of the situation as opposed to the feasibility engineering-wise.
But Kyle, like, if you put them in Alaska, the federal government owns something like 90% of the land in Alaska. And then you get around the rancher problem is you just drive it around on BLM land, Bureau of Land Management land in Alaska, then you don't have that kind of political problem, I think.
This episode of NucleCast is brought to you by the Ann Law Deterrence Center, whose mission is to educate Americans about the nuclear enterprise and strategic deterrence.
Well, that's the same issue, you know, 70% of the state of Arizona is owned by the federal. The government owns a majority, you know, once you go from, like, say, Kansas west, you know, all the way to the west coast.
Yeah.
The government owns a majority of the land. So there's, you know, there's lots of federal land. But I've thought of things, you know, like, you know, this would have been probably more feasible with, like, Midget Man. Like, Sentinels is longer than Minuteman, so it's kind of too long to fit on a conventional 18-wheeler. But if you could hide it in an 18-wheeler and just drive it on normal highways all over the country, and, you know, then, and you would have a hard time knowing exactly which truck it is and which truck it's not. That makes it almost impossible to target and impossible to know where it is. Rail mobile systems would, you know, be good ones, because if you can you know, box them if they're boxed up, and before they ever hit a rail, nobody knows what's in that box. And, you know, it's sort of like some of the Russian systems where they are canisterized and pop out of cargo containers. You know, there's, or, you know, what if you put it in the back of a C-7 and you fly it around and then you drop it out and then it launches. We tried that in the 60s and it works. So there's lots of ways to sort of complicate this for the Russians or the Chinese, and in ways that they just have a heck of a time sort of figuring out exactly where it is and what the Americans are doing and what their intentions are.
Yeah, no, 100%. And also, like, I do worry about the day in which the Columbia may no longer be invisible. And so if the Columbia's, its role is to be the assured second strike that cannot be detected and can unleash, you know, a metric case of whoop-ass on your opponent. If that no longer is undetectable, you want an assured second strike capability. And I would offer that some type of mobile ICBM capability that's MIRVed with three warheads per could be a backup second strike capability as well. And so, and that's why, I mean, that's why we need to start thinking more creatively about this. And I think that's really what Kyle and Rebecca and I were going for was, hey, community, we really need to start thinking more creatively and start thinking of other options.
Yeah, that's sort of been one of the, I don't think most Americans really understand the true vulnerability of submarines that has been there, you know, for decades. I mean, most people don't realize that both we and the Russians have, you know, attack submarines, track and kill ballistic missile submarines. That's their purpose. And, you know, we have set our attack submarines outside the ballistic missile submarine pens of the Soviets, and they've set them outside of our pens. And there are two publicly known instances in which a Soviet submarine was leaving port. You know, we pulled in behind it and then we rear-ended it. And then there was a case in which one of our subs pulled out of Scotland, and then we thought we detected them. We stopped, and then they rear-ended us. So there is a level of vulnerability coming in and out of port that I don't think most people fundamentally appreciate or while in port for submarines. And, you know, ICBMs, this is why I've always loved them, is because they mitigate that vulnerability. So as you guys think about this and as you sort of move forward, do you have sort of next steps? Are you essentially tossing the idea out? Do you have further work that you want to do? Is there additional advocacy? What are you thinking in terms of, you know, hey, this is an idea. How do we want to further this idea, you know, down the road?
I think in terms of next steps, I think it comes back. I think the fundamental problem, just thinking more broadly about this, is political, in the sense that we need national leadership to start talking to the American people about these issues, and not just ICBM vulnerability or the need for greater capacity in the sea-based leg. We need to start talking about the conventional end of things as well, how we need more of our conventional posture, how a strong conventional posture is linked to nuclear deterrence, and how you can't do one without the other, because we're not going to get more out of our defense industrial base, even once we get the defense industrial base reset, unless the national leadership starts talking to the American people about these things. If you look back at the Cold War in the mid-1970s, Ronald Reagan was giving pretty detailed speeches to the American public about the state of the Soviet-American balance, the balance in terms of, you know, functional balances, the strategic nuclear balance, and he was giving pretty detailed addresses on the NATO-Warsaw Pact balance on the central region, even on the northern flank. And so we eventually got to the military buildup later on in the Carter administration, and then the Reagan years, not just because the Soviets invaded Afghanistan or the Soviets were knocking down this country in Africa, Angola, name whatever evil Soviet plan was going on at that point, we were able to wring out more defense dollars because Reagan and other people in Congress had been speaking about these issues since the mid-1970s. And so when the threat environment eventually changed in the late 1970s, it was much easier to conduct that defense buildup and to raise the defense budget to the heights that it was by 1983. And so I think that would be the first steps, is solving that political problem, which is to start explaining to the American people these problems. And really that we're facing a threat environment that's at its worst since World War II. And it's kind of shocking to me that there's not greater public discussion about this. Senator Wicker discusses these issues all the time. There are people out there, but I'd like to see more from the White House and other areas of our national leadership discussing these issues.
Let me ask you, Bob, do you think that there's, do you think there's any appetite for it, given, you know, like when Reagan, or when President Reagan, well, before he was President Reagan, was out there making these public speeches, we lived in a, you know, the federal government spent dollars far differently than it does today. And so if you just look at federal tax revenues, about $4 trillion last year, and federal spending on entitlement programs was $4.2 trillion. So if you look at how we spend very differently. And I worry and fear that because, you know, 25% of Americans receive their health care through, say, Medicaid, that they're always going to choose the entitlement over the defense dollar. And I wonder if we could replicate what we did in the 1980s with the buildup.
It would be challenging to do for a number of reasons. I think the politics is not there to get a Reagan-era defense buildup. But we can get kind of a mini Reagan-era defense buildup. And I think that is within the realm of possibility. Nukes are a hard one. No one likes them. You know, American presidents from Ronald Reagan onwards have wanted to get to a world without nuclear weapons, and who can blame them? You know, I think that the president has to make the case. And by the president, I Donald Trump or someone else, right? After President Trump leaves office, has to make the case to American people that says, I don't like nuclear weapons. I wish they were never invented. But that's not the world we live in. The world we live in is a very dangerous one, and we know that our adversaries are pursuing these capabilities. They're building these capabilities not solely to deter attack on their own nations, but to engage in nuclear war fighting. And the United States is second to none in trying to get to a world without nuclear weapons, with President Reagan at Reykjavik, with President Obama. This has been a bipartisan desire, but that's not the world we live in. And until we do live in that world, we have to field a force that can credibly deter adversaries from carrying out strategic attack. As such, this is what we need to do. And I think we have to have that kind of high-level leadership. To be determined if we'll see that, you know, in the coming years.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, we're getting low on time, so I'm going to bring out Bob the Genie. And as I rub the magic lamp, Bob grants all guests three wishes, but you guys have to share them. So, okay. You know, that's a tough part for y'all. So three wishes. Did you want to, were you wanting to go first, Bob? You seem
no,
like.
No, I'll give Kyle, you get two wishes. I'll take one. How about that?
All right. I'll start off with the first one. I'll go with a minimum of 200 B-21s. We need more out of our, bomber leg.
All right. Yeah. Mine is that we reverse the half century long trend of shrinking the American arsenal, and we start expanding the American operationally deployed arsenal. And that means not extending New START in February. It means uploading the ICBM leg, and it means pulling some W-80s out of the ready reserve stockpile and slapping them on some TLAMs and JASM-ERs and LRASMs until we can get the nuclear enterprise rocking and rolling and cranking out warheads at scale so that we can deter our adversaries. But it's time to start building up.
Yeah. And so then I guess that leaves one more, a third, and I'll go with a, you know, we'll need at least 14, 15, maybe even 16 Columbia I think that's a good way to end the third and final wish, I guess.
Yeah. Well, there we go. So we're going to have a bigger nuclear arsenal. We're going to, we're going to overcome the three body problem in a very distinct and deliberate way. So, it seems like it's all feasible, right? It's all this stuff is feasible. We're Americans. This is what I think we've lost, is the fact that we are in fact Americans. And, we're the ones that went to the moon. We won World War II. We've done a lot of great things. We invented the internet. We invented the iPhone. I mean, how important was that? So I think we could probably do whatever we want if we put our minds to it. So,
well, the iPhone will be the downfall of Western civilization, though,
Adam. That's probably true. Yeah, that's, that will be the day that the nukes launch. We'll be looking at our iPhones and never know it came. So, all right. Any final thoughts to wrap it up? Any kind of, going away, kind of your drop the mic and walk off the stage kind of final thoughts?
No, just that it's been a real pleasure to join the show again.
Thanks.
I would just quote the great strategist Admiral Akbar from Return of the Jedi in regards to New Start. It is a trap. Don't do it. Don't extend it.
All right. Well, Kyle Balzer, Bob Peters, thanks once again for joining us. And of course, thanks to you, the listeners, for joining us on this episode of NucleCast, and we'll see you next time. Always great to have a discussion with Bob and Kyle. It's iron sharpening iron. We, like to sort of test and vet ideas. And, that's a thing that you can do among friends is, you test those ideas and, you see why you're thinking about them. And so this was a great opportunity to do that. It's always good to see Bob, always good to see Kyle. Hopefully that, was, at least an interesting discussion for you as well.
This has been a production of the ANWA Deterrent Center, a 501c3 that seeks to educate key decision makers, stakeholders, and the public to ensure a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent. Our executive producer is Kimberly Charrington, and this episode has been engineered and mixed by David Krumpel. Help us grow our followers by sharing it and follow the show on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at NucleCast.